This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones where we greet each other and, you know, talk about what's on our mind, share our news and opinions, are very important to our communities. And today we're going to talk about something that is very unique and new to many of us, and we're going to learn something about a cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. Joining us is Ryan Berry. He's the CEO of Fargo Bitcoin. And Ryan, I guess if I were going to the corner cafe on Main Street and I was going to buy a cup of coffee, I don't think I could yet use a Bitcoin, could I?
Not quite yet, although you're getting to that point.
Okay, so let's get really basic here. What is a Bitcoin?
Well, what is a Bitcoin is actually a very complicated thing, but for all intents and purposes, you can think of it just like digital cash. So a lot of people ask, well, where is a Bitcoin kept? Where does a Bitcoin live?
Yeah.
Well, a Bitcoin is kept on what's called a blockchain. Now, that's the underlying technology behind Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is this concept of what's called a blockchain. And that's actually the technology that's going to, you'll see in your everyday life here in the next, I mean, in about 15 years, it'll be ubiquitous in pretty much most things in your life. Now, Bitcoin is what's called the native asset or the currency of a blockchain. And so with Bitcoin, it's just the money that we use on this particular blockchain.
Hmm.
And this, you can think of a blockchain as just a series of business ledgers that says
that exist online.
That exist online between a network of computers, just very similar to the internet.
So who uses Bitcoins?
Well, people right now don't use it as a currency, so to speak, as much. We use it more like a store of wealth because, A, it's still hitting mainstream and people need to integrate it into so they can accept it at point of sale.
So like gold? Is it?
Well, yes. Right now it acts like gold, but it also has the ability to be used transactionally. Like there are some places around Fargo that do it, but also Microsoft accepts Bitcoin, Expedia.com, so you can travel with it. Overstock.com accepts Bitcoin. There's a lot of different car companies that are starting to accept it. You can start to purchase real estate with it. As people hear about it and as it picks up this mainstream adoption, most places, almost everywhere, will take, if not Bitcoin, a certain cryptocurrency.
Well, I've spent my whole life learning an analog currency called the dollar, and I can get a dime or a penny or a nickel or a quarter. Can I get a piece of a Bitcoin?
Yes, you can. And in fact, that's one of psychologically, we always think of things in 1, 2, 3, you know, and then those solid numbers. And so what we call it, a Bitcoin can be divided down to 0.7 zeros and a 1. So it goes down 8 decimal places behind the decimal. And so that's very big in computer programming as far as bytes. But as far as what that insinuates to a regular person is basically we call that one Satoshi. So if you take 0.7 zeros and a 1, that's one Satoshi. And so a lot of times when people are talking about, you know, Bitcoin, they'll say when you're in communities that are familiar with Bitcoin, is that 30,000 Satoshis or is that 500,000 Satoshis? And so that allows you to break down a Bitcoin into much smaller units. And so 10 million Satoshis is one Bitcoin.
Yowza. Okay. So this is sort of a new kind of thing between a commodity and a currency.
Yes, exactly. It is – then that's why they're having so much trouble at the SEC level as far as regulating it. Should they regulate it as a commodity? Should they regulate it as a security? Is it regulated as a currency? One thing I did want to touch on with that article with the Fargo Forum was that Ryan Johnson, I believe, mm-hmm. wrote that no country had recognized it as legal tender yet, which was not true. Japan has actually recognized it as legal tender.
And the name that's applied to Bitcoin is a Japanese name, isn't it? Whether or not there's an individual or a group of people.
Well, with Bitcoin, a bit is just binary information.
Yeah, but who invented it?
Well, the inventor is actually not known.
Yeah, but it has a Japanese name.
Yep, Satoshi Nakamoto. And it's actually, well, I guess it's seen that, or it's well believed that there's about, you know, about 15 people that could have invented it, and it's most likely a group of people that were a part of this, what was called the cypherpunk email list. And basically it was people who started seeing what the internet was back in, once after the 1950s, once World War II got over in the 40s, they started releasing all this cryptographical information that you could use with computers. And these guys started seeing, this is great. Now we can protect our information and use these computer networks. And it's great. And nobody can monitor us. And the government obviously didn't like that. They want to monitor it. And so these cypherpunks started this email so they could keep this technology going. And so this cryptocurrency, or the math behind it, these hashing algorithms and proof-of-work concepts, these allow us to not rely on trust of a third party. They allow us to use math and science to regulate our trade as opposed to government officials.
But we probably get a little apprehensive when we think about these invisible people that we don't know, who may or may not be fabulously wealthy now, because we have these other kind of things that are online, like Anonymous or WikiLeaks, you know. The price of this thing has just shot up this year. Why?
People are seeing the value and the potential behind it. With Bitcoin as well as just blockchain technology in general, as a total environment that I like to call the cryptosphere. As people see that it's going to be useful, obviously people will say it's speculation, which right now it is. However, we can use these to transact. I myself have purchased things with Bitcoin Cash, with Bitcoin, with Litecoin. I have purchased things. One of the biggest problems with it becoming actually usable currency is going to be scalability. That's the amount of transactions that the network can handle. And once that's solved, the sky's the limit. The World Economic Forum in 2028 views that it will take over about a $30 trillion market cap, the cryptosphere, or cryptocurrency in general. And right now, Bitcoin shares about a 40 to 60% market share. So even if you're thinking roughly $30 trillion market cap for the whole thing, 50% roughly for Bitcoin, that's $15 trillion. There's 21 million Bitcoin. That's roughly $450,000 per Bitcoin.
Yowza. It was approaching 17,000 this month, isn't it?
It was sniffing 20K. Went up to 19,4 or 19,8, depending on what exchange you were looking at.
So that's about $5,000 just in a week.
Yes. And right now it's at about, last time I checked, 16. So it's probably between 15,500 and 1,600.
Well, that makes it seem like a speculative nightmare, actually.
It's very volatile, and that's because right now it doesn't have the scalability to actually perform as the currency. Which will be solved by things like the Lightning Network is going to be their biggest champion. But right now, if anyone's heard of things like hard forks, those are always things trying to make it better. Biggest thing, block size right now is what everybody's talking about in the intimate crypto circles.
Yeah, so you're talking this is way outside my understanding here. Considering our ongoing concern about online security, for example, how secure is Bitcoin?
You have a better chance of going to sleep tonight and waking up on Mars tomorrow than anybody actually hacking your Bitcoin. When you hear about somebody's Bitcoin getting hacked, like in a South Korean Bitcoin hack, or somebody was got hacked at a Starbucks, somebody will get hacked. That's not Bitcoin getting hacked. That's that person using not proper security procedures. Like if you were to leave your wallet on the bar pool table or your bar table and you went to the bathroom, you come back, it's gone. Well, that wasn't a good place to have your wallet. So when people can get hacked, that's when, say, you have your public or your private key, which is basically your private key is what you know that has your value, that has your Bitcoin in it. And if somebody is able to get that, they can take your Bitcoin. Now, how do they get that? They cannot get that through using brute force, hacking, or computer technology right now. That's the whole thing about somebody waking up on Mars tomorrow. We have a better chance of that than somebody hacking your Bitcoin.
So do I have to, when I write my will, leave the access to my Bitcoin in the will and hope the lawyer doesn't read it?
That's been a problem because when people die, if somebody doesn't have that information, gone. Mm-hmm. That Bitcoin is now gone. Nobody can retrieve that and get that back.
Oh, boy. Are there other uses for the blockchain besides Bitcoin? It sounds like this has got some other applications.
Yes, it's got tons of applications, and that's actually where we're going to see blockchain really flourish. As opposed to just using it as currencies. Blockchain will be used for things like our identities, as far as keeping it secure and safe, and so other big data companies can't use our information unless they're actually giving us a little bit of the cutback.
Is this ultimately the way to reduce the incidence of hacking and
yes.
and people's secure information and all that kind of stuff?
Yes. This is Internet 2.0. This will be built upon the decentralized Internet to help it have regulation rules, things like smart contracts, uniquely individual items online that can't be copied.
When will we start seeing this? I mean, individuals like me.
Well, as far as Bitcoin, that's most of our first interactions with it. But every company right now, big ones, are looking into this and have some kind of R&D set aside to look for it. Similar with Hyperledger and Walmart, with a few of their companies, if something gets pulled off of their shelf, it goes right back to another company via the blockchain. You can use the blockchain for things like medical records. So that's going to be a big one. So we'll have concealed medical records that you can give around to different hospitals, but keep it safe and secure so it only goes to the people you want it to. And then once you don't want them to have it, they don't have it anymore.
Well, right now, the dollar is kind of the world's currency.
Yep.
The Chinese yuan is also you know, vying for that kind of legitimacy as well. But are we heading toward a universal international currency?
Yes. That's one of Bitcoin's biggest things is because it's decentralized, nobody owns it, so it will be a world value unit. So it will allow us – now, when it's all said and done, I think – different countries will have their own personal, their own country cryptocurrency that eventually is based off of the overwhelming, or I'll call it Bitcoin now, but it could be something else at that time.
It could be renamed.
Exactly. It could be ADA. I don't know. But as far as that goes, they'll have their own cryptocurrency that they exchange with the universal store of value, and it will track the things they want it to track. So it will do the things like taxes, and it will do the things where money goes, why it goes, and for what purposes.
Let's talk about two elements of the Bitcoin universe that I don't quite understand either. One is called Bitcoin mining. What does that involve?
Well, Bitcoin mining, that has to do – this is going to get technical. it's very tough. But basically, your Bitcoin are the – your miners are the ones who keep the blockchain secure, safe, and going. Because when you want to do a transaction, who puts it into the blockchain?
So the mining get paid for that effort with
yes.
the Bitcoin.
Yes, they get paid with that effort through Bitcoin. Every block that is added to the blockchain, because you can think of a blockchain just like there's one block, there's two blocks, now there's three blocks, now there's four blocks.
So the more miners, the better the blockchain, or the more Bitcoin? I don't quite understand.
Well, miner, it takes a certain amount of hashing power to find a block in the blockchain. Now, as more miners, there's more hashing power. However, set in the algorithm for Bitcoin, a block appears every 10 minutes. So there is a really complex math equation called a nonce, N-O-N-C-E.
Wow.
And so that is basically the regulator, so a block only appears at 10-minute intervals. And so all these miners put the transactions in, and then once they've got the transaction, the block set, they all go for this really hard mathematical equation. And the one that gets it, and the nonce gets harder or less hard depending on how much hash power and the network difficulty. And so basically, whoever gets that gets to add that block. And then the whole process starts over again for the next 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, it's still I'm going to have to really study this and learn about and start using it, I suppose. that might help. But are you a Bitcoin miner?
Yes.
How many Bitcoin miners do you think there are around town? Quite a few?
You know, a lot of people like to keep it a secret if they're mining because they don't want people coming in and stealing their equipment because it can be worth quite a bit of money. But you can mine on your home computer.
But it probably has to be a pretty good one, doesn't it?
Well, that's the thing. So your normal desktop computer today, if you're just using your CPU, you could mine probably 200 Satoshis a day.
That's not much.
That's not much.
Now,
however,
if you're talking 10 million in a Bitcoin.
Exactly. If you're talking 10 million in Bitcoin. However, if you're looking at $450,000 a Bitcoin, a Satoshi's worth a small amount. I mean, still a decent amount of money.
That's a long way to go yet.
But exactly. It's a long way to go.
Okay.
But so you can mine with your regular computer, but nowadays any kind of practical mining where you're not just trying to learn about the blockchain and learning basic information. If you're actually looking to make money and profit off of that mining, you need specialized equipment.
Why wouldn't a government just put together a supercomputer and mine some Bitcoin?
They can. Mm-hmm. However, they would never take over more than 51% of the network to make Bitcoin hackable, or I guess the 51% attack theory. Because the largest computer network outside of the internet as far as drawing electricity and computing power is the Bitcoin blockchain, which I usually refer to as the legacy blockchain.
Wow. Well, we talked about Bitcoin mining. What's this hardware wallet?
So there's different – what a Bitcoin wallet is. A Bitcoin wallet, think of it just like a regular wallet. It holds your Bitcoin. But what that actually is a public key and a private key. And your public key is the one you generate and give out to other people so they can give you Bitcoin. And your private key is the one that you have to give away if you want someone else to take your Bitcoin.
Now, is this a number or is it like a password thing?
It's like a password, except for it's a very long, complex number.
So you'd want it in where you push a button and it says, there's my number.
Exactly.
Okay. Wow.
And so basically there's soft wallets, hardware wallets. Soft wallet would be something like if you were using Coinbase or if you were using blockchain.io. That is basically on their server is where your code is.
Mm-hmm.
So they technically own it. You don't. And so they are a centralized entity that could be hacked. So when you have it, you have your key. If you download a certain type of wallet, like a computer, most phone wallets are soft wallets. But this hardware wallet is basically, like I said, it's a USB on steroids. It allows you to take from some soft wallet and put it onto the hardware wallet. But the biggest thing that these – what I use is a Ledger Nano S. The biggest thing is that it doesn't put it on your computer log. It can transfer it over without giving the key even to your CPU.
I've lost a lot of USB drives. Is this one I would want to keep a very close eye on?
Yeah, you should probably – if you don't plan on trading and you have this USB drive, I would recommend – and it's got a decent amount of Bitcoin on it. You put it in a safety deposit box. Otherwise, right now, Coinbase is a very secure place to keep, you know, under less than a Bitcoin, maybe under less than a half Bitcoin. You could feel safe keeping it there without fear of, you know, when it goes away, it's never going to be there. But if you have more than about a half Bitcoin, you know, probably keep it on a hardware wallet and keep it somewhere where it's safe.
Ryan Berry is the CEO of Fargo Bitcoin. You can find out more. There's a website. It needs to be fleshed out a bit yet, but it's fargobitcoin.org. So, Ryan, what kind of business is this? What happens at Fargo Bitcoin?
Well, it originally started off of basically an investing fund that I did for myself. Obviously, that became profitable enough to incorporate as Fargo Bitcoin LLC. And now my overall goal is to bring cryptocurrency, blockchain, and Bitcoin into the Fargo community and help ease that transformation. And so I guess I help business owners as far as getting signed up for BitPay. BitPay is a company basically that allows you to accept cryptocurrencies. Right now, Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin. They're looking at Litecoin and Ethereum. But basically that allows you to take Bitcoin, accept it, and they have their own exchange that – so right when you accept it, it converts it to your fiat currency or your USD or your yen, puts it into your bank account. So you don't have to deal with it in any way, shape, or form.
So you are a consultant? You help people put this together? You make a living doing that?
Yes, I help people do that as well as I help them I do a lot of informational aspects as far as for somebody who is investing would like information on different kinds of blockchains and why they're good. So not investing advice in any way, shape, or form, but what cryptocurrencies or coins or digital tokens and blockchains are good and why. Like certain ones, one of the big ones coming up, IOTA, Internet of Things Asset. They have a revolutionary way of doing the blockchain called the Tangle. And obviously without getting very technical, it seems like a more efficient way. And so little technologies like these with these little cryptocurrencies are the reason that some of them are going to be successful and some of them aren't. Blockchain is very popular, but 90% of those coins are going to be worth nothing.
Okay. Well, that makes me very concerned about Bitcoin because what goes up can come down. We've seen gold do that. Mm-hmm. The dollar used to be tied to the value of gold. Mm-hmm. It's now tied to the full faith and,
credit of the United States of America.
What is the potential for that? I mean,
for
the Bitcoin to simply fold.
As far as Bitcoin itself or the blockchain industry, because there will be one champion as far as the universal currency
goes. So right now people who are investing are betting on Bitcoin.
Yes.
Okay.
And right now that's the most well-known one. There are some problems, and Bitcoin, especially right now with the 8-megabyte Bitcoin Cash nipping at their heels with usability as far as a currency, not just a store of wealth, Bitcoin needs to get their stuff in a group and get the transactional volume handled.
Well, knowing what you know, and you mm-hmm. sure know a whole lot more about this than I can even imagine, how many years down the line before we are actually individually, me, a retired guy almost, using cryptocurrency as a matter of, you know, just daily transactions?
I would say absolutely in 5 years. I don't want to say presumptuous with three.
Wow. So it's coming quickly.
Yes. And when it comes, it will come quickly because we already have the cell phone in our hands. We want our lives to revolve around that, being able to use everything individually from our cell phone.
So the biggest pitfalls from right now before mm-hmm. we get 3 to 5 years into this, mm-hmm. what are those? What should we be careful about?
Scalability, obviously we can't do it quite yet because we can't do the amount of transactions that we want to do on the network.
Yeah, because right now if you got a Visa or a MasterCard,
instant.
You can only imagine how many of those are happening every minute.
Exactly. Well, Visa can, for instance, can take 11,000 to 12,000 transactions a second. The mm-hmm. Bitcoin, the actual legacy blockchain, the Bitcoin takes about 350,000 transactions a day.
Yowza. That's slow.
That's slow. Exactly. Now, there's reasons why. Main thing is the megabytes in the block. But there can be bad things to just jumping those up to 8 megabytes like Bitcoin Cash. There can be a lot of things that can go wrong technically.
Well, that again is what
concerns us. Denial of service attack is one of the biggest ones. And so that's why people look at Bitcoin Cash now and think, oh, it's exploding. It's got the 8 megabytes. It's got the scalability because it handles the transaction problem. It must be the greatest thing ever. But there's a lot of things on the technicality side of it that fall through.
Well, when you go on, you watch cable TV late at night, you'll see a lot of commercials for gold or mm-hmm. commodities, precious mm-hmm. metals. Are we going to start seeing Bitcoin commercials?
Yes.
In the same kinds of places? I mean, because it's highly speculative at
this
point.
Yes, you will see those. And I just want to point this one out from the Ryan Johnson article in the forum, just because I think this is one of the best statements I've heard from Dan Hendrickson, the spokesperson for the Better Business Bureau of North Dakota and Minnesota. Hendrickson said, the high-tech nature of Bitcoin, too, can make it hard for the uninitiated to make sure they're getting what they think they're buying and making it an attractive place for scammers.
Okay.
That is absolutely true. And that's where the developers and people like myself are working to make it seamless and work and make it work the way we want it to work.
And you referred a couple of times to this article by Ryan Johnson in the Fargo Forum, which was published December 15th under the headline, Bitcoin is Booming, but Is It Here to Stay? Ryan Berry, the CEO of Fargo Bitcoin. Again, if you want to find out a bit more about that business, fargobitcoin.org. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah. Well, and that's the big thing with how I make my living. I go to people's houses and show them where they can trade, how to get set up for it, and then I give them a basic rundown of what Bitcoin is, the blockchain, and then great blockchain companies.
Okay. Well, it's a brave new world.
Yep.
Coming up next on Main Street, Chef Rosie and what's happening, but first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota is the first state in the nation to try telling farmers how to apply fertilizer to their crops. The state agriculture department has drafted a rule meant to cut down on nitrogen runoff. Nitrogen fertilizer is the main source of nitrate pollution in the state's groundwater. Steve Suppen with the Minneapolis-based Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, or IATP, says Minnesota's rule is a significant step in the right direction.
The only regulations pertaining to fertilizer have to do with its storage. Fertilizer application is an unregulated industry.
Suppen says farmers who focus on sustainable agriculture are already using crop rotation as one method to reduce fertilizer application. But the fertilizer industry is also working on solutions. Solutions he says may or may not work for Minnesota crops and Minnesota farmers.
The fertilizer companies who would like to sell more fertilizer, but what they may sell is going to be a much more expensive fertilizer. Well, how do farmers pay for that when what they get at their local grain elevator is a price that's below their cost of production?
Suppan says the last thing farmers need is for their production costs to rise, but he's optimistic that research could yield a practical solution to the nitrate problem. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is taking public comment and holding listening sessions before the rule goes into effect next fall. The North Dakota Health Department is tinkering with school immunization requirements heading into the new year. The rules involve the minimum number of required shots for K to 12 students. Starting January 1st, the hepatitis B vaccine is required for all children attending child care. Other changes for the 2018 and 2019 school year involve the vaccine for meningitis and whooping cough. The health department's Lexi Barber says the new requirements are consistent with recommendations by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
All states allow medical exemptions. Obviously, we don't want kids getting vaccinated if they shouldn't be. But then in North Dakota, we also have those personal belief exemptions.
Barber says the compliant date is also being changed to October 1st.
Previously, students had 30 days after the start of school to get up to date on their requirements. And after that, they needed to be excluded from school. We changed that now to just say by October 1st, just to kind of standardize schools kind of picking different dates randomly. So we just decided to put October 1st. Kids need to be up to date.
Barber says ensuring vaccinations are up to date is the best way to keep children healthy. And accommodations have been made so both men and women will be able to use a temporary homeless shelter established at the National Guard Armory in Moorhead. Up until now, only men were allowed because of staffing issues. Clay County Emergency Manager Brian Green says volunteers for the homeless community have agreed to help, allowing women to take advantage of the shelter during the cold snap.
The way it's supposed to work is that if they come together as a family, the children, the adults, which mean the separate adults of male or female, will be vetted out of the homes and then placed into this shelter. The family and children will stay in the regular shelters.
Representatives for the homeless and leaders from Fargo, Moorhead, and Cass and Clay counties will look for an alternative to the armory in the coming days. The shelter will close January 4th. Governor Dayton authorized the use of the building and guard members after a call from Moorhead Mayor Delray Williams. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a history professor at North Dakota State University, and not just any professor, he's a distinguished professor of history. He's also an author, written several books, of course, about history, and he writes essays for us he calls the Plainsfolk Essays, which he also voices. So get ready to hear Tom Ezern's distinctive voice with his essay, A One-Spotted Hog.
It seems like yesterday, but likely it was close to two decades ago when I entertained the grandkids with our own version of the Lutheran carol, Away in a Manger. Our prairie stanzas were set in a snow-covered landscape and populated with animals suited to the locale. Howling coyotes, barking retrievers, joining the usual cast of farmyard creatures. Denizens vocally present, howling and barking on cue. Yeah, which gets me thinking, just what are or were our typical animals, and now I'm thinking domestic animals, here on the Great Plains in the homesteading heyday, the late 19th century? What breeds of livestock were a part of everyday pioneer life? There are clues in that great ballad of overland migration, Sweet Betsy from Pike. The opening stanza informs us that Betsy and her lover Ike ventured onto the plains with 2 yoke of cattle, a large yeller dog, a tall Shanghai rooster, and a one-spotted hog. So let's begin at the end with that one-spotted hog. This sounds like a Hampshire hog, one of the oldest named breeds in America. It's a black and white beast with a white belt or spot across its dark midsection. Compare this reference in Sweet Betsy to the later one in another standard folk song, Dakota Land. My chickens, they are Plymouth Rock, my horses, Clydesdale, Norman stock. My cattle, Durham, very fine, and Poland China are my swine. A Poland China swine originated in the Ohio Valley from the admixture of Hampshire, Berkshire, and what were known as Big China hogs. They were huge. So the latter reference in Dakota Land states the preferred standard for prairie pig farming, while the earlier reference in Sweet Betsy confesses the scruffiness of Betsy and Ike's livestock. They did, however, possess a stylish Shanghai rooster. A Shanghai was a gaudy bird, iridescent as a ringneck pheasant. It figures in a lot of hillbilly songs in the country music lexicon. On the other hand, our Dakota Land singer boasted the preferred dual-purpose chicken breed of the mid-19th century, Plymouth Rock, that practical, speckled beauty. Horses? Sweet Betsy's were nondescript, but the Dakota Land farmer specified that his were Clydesdale Norman stock. This was a well-crafted bit of crossbreeding. The massive Clydesdale line provided the power for braking and other heavy work, while the injection of Norman blood produced a more nimble beast, better for such work as drawing a mower or binder. And cattle. Much as we may revere the iconic longhorn and credit its place in history, it appears that continental European breeds largely populated the plains. Of these, the shorthorn predominated early. The Hereford and Angus herd books of the plains date mainly from the 1890s and later. A favored variety in the dual-purpose shorthorn breed was the Durham cow, a mottled beast whose line goes back to the origins of the shorthorn breed. My folk songs may not be authoritative sources as to livestock lineage, but they are at least an index to the animal inventories of prairie farming.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, Chef Rosie joins us to talk about more food trends for 2018.
The 21st Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music will be held Saturday, January 20th at the stage at Island Park, featuring Brenda Weiler, Rosie Savageau-Nestingen, Laura Jossend, Emily Holt, Haley E. Rydell, and many more. Tickets available at 21stcelebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. For complete information on all 3 days of events, go to debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. It's time to talk about food and food trends.
We are continuing a conversation we've been having now and again for the past few weeks here as we look at what is changing in the world of food. And you are talking about one on the list here called clean menus. I assume that doesn't just mean the actual menu is clean.
No, not at all. And, you know, it's interesting because we're talking about food trends for 2018. We're continuing this discussion, and unfortunately or fortunately, we could talk about this all year, and just by the time we finish the list, we'll be on 2019.
There you go.
But it's fun, and some of these, it's a big circle. They come around. But the one we're talking about right now is clean menus. People want to see no different than in the grocery store. We want to see a clean label. We don't want to see a label for a chocolate chip cookie that has 27 chemicals, and by the way, there's flour and butter and chocolate chips, somewhere in that 27 ingredient list. The same thing in the restaurant industry. We want to list clean food. We want to showcase the source of the food, the time it was harvested, but also, most importantly, the fact that so the guests can really feel and see and know, is it organic? Is it natural? Is it grass-fed? Is it grain-fed? Is it, you know, the time of harvest, the time of catching? But that's a really big thing. And people are – we in the restaurant industry are required to keep much more detailed inventory of where we got our products and when we got our products. When it comes to oysters and clams and seafood and fish, 6 months they can come into the restaurant and they can ask, where did the oysters come from on September 12th? And you better have the ticket. The actual ticket of where it came from and who you bought it from.
So if it's not on the menu, the server should be able to answer the question, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not always the server, right, every server at the table, but they can come back with the answer. And we have to take great pride in when we write the menu now, we're writing it with more details. I don't believe in just putting, as the chef sitting at the table, I'm always asked, if it says on the menu, Aunt Sally's Waffles, and they'll say to me, what is Aunt Sally's Waffles? I'll go, I don't know. Who's Aunt Sally?
That person's Aunt Sally.
Yeah, it's something that somebody's aunt made, and they may have used chicken or lamb or, you know, but it doesn't tell you anything at all. Or, you know, Flapjack City or whatever the name may be. It's something – I don't know what it is. So people like to see exactly what they're getting. Not every single item, every herb, every spice, but much more detail. They want it to be clean.
So the menu has a bit of a recipe flavor to it, a little more detail than just beef and potato.
As my friend who was a marketing VP for Holiday Inn once said, the best surprise is no surprise. Because you want to get what you saw on the menu. You don't want to get it. There's so many times I will say, I've ordered this item because it has fermented black beans and fresh avocado. And then it comes and there's no fermented black beans and there's no avocado. And I'll say, hey, there's supposed to be. And of course, oh, it's in there. You just can't find it. And, you know, but we have to also be true to ourselves and deliver what we say on that clean menu as well. We have to make sure that those ingredients are there.
And we have people with allergies and issues that they want to verify on the menu as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point because – and then, you know, when we buy food from so many sources that come from so many manufacturers and so many – we in the Midwest, you know, we can have an organic, natural field. But if they're spraying the field next to ours, and if it should happen to be windy, which it is, I think, daily here, the non-windy day, so there is overspray that comes into the next field, and that causes all kinds of other distinctions in food.
Well, how about another topic, a trend here, and that is food waste reduction. We are more aware of that than we used to be.
You know, the big one is one that Ashley brought up. And one of these other discussions was styrofoam. You know, we all know that styrofoam is something that, you know, the thing we learned, oh, my God, must have been 100 years ago. But styrofoam never goes away. You can go into a landfill that has been used for 100 years and the styrofoam box that's there, guess what? It won't have broken down or was biodegradable at all. So now we're looking for items, not only the takeout items, because we have to be really careful. We think that we're using biodegradable, that we think we're using something that is natural and will break down. But if in your community, whether it's the clear glass jars or the green glass jars or the paper box that is biodegradable, if you don't have a system in your community to actually collect those and put those in the proper places, it's hocus pocus. You're playing a game. You're trying to do the right thing, and you're paying. Don't get me wrong, when you start buying those biodegradable items, takeout items, they cost you a lot more. But now we're taking it another step much further. I love the idea of mason jars are very affordable. I like the idea when soda pop was all returnable bottles. You know, there was a time when if you bought a case of Coca-Cola.
Or beer.
Yeah, and you got a nickel for each one. And a nickel, well, not only, it wasn't just the nickel, but it was the fact that you were recycling that bottle. And remember when Coca-Cola bottles looked like they'd been around the cycle 27 times because they were beat up. But there was something that's really much more food waste reduction, not food waste, but the actual jar. So I love that whole idea of being more environmentally sustainable in the food that we use. And I'll give one quick example here. When we were at the Culinary Olympics in Moscow, Russia, we were the Culinary Olympic team on the 8th floor of the hotel preparing our foods for the Olympic presentation. And the Russian team and the Polish team and the German team were on the 3rd floor and the 4th floor. And we as Americans, being as wasteful as we could possibly be, would send our garbage down the elevators. Lo and behold, we found that culinary teams from other countries were taking our garbage, going through it, and recycling because, you know, we think nothing of taking a head of celery and just chopping off the root end and right. Chopping off the leaves. And we just, you know, we like the hearts of celery. That's what we like. And we like the – or iceberg lettuce or romaine, the heart of romaine, the heart of iceberg, or the tops of tomatoes, whatever it is, it's all usable. Go into your favorite grocery store one morning and see how much food is wasted.
Well, there's also an effort in some communities. Fargo Moorhead, for example, has our daily bread, and that is where they pick up food from restaurants that would otherwise be thrown out and get it to people.
Yep, that's a good example.
France made it illegal recently for restaurants to waste food and that they were going to be more required to donate it or, you know, very same program, but a nationwide law.
Look how few grocery stores in this country don't have the plastic giveaway bags anymore. And yet I read an article just a week ago. Bangladesh, we think of as a pretty backward country, at least in my lifetime. They've eliminated those bags 20 years ago.
Right.
So because they blow everywhere.
They blow everywhere. Yeah. They kill fish. They kill, you know, it's just they're not right.
Are you aware of much of a movement at all when it comes to the cutlery, like the plastic knives, forks, and spoons that come out with every single meal and why you need a fork and a knife if you've ordered soup, you know, stuff like that?
That's a good point. You know, we can buy bamboo knives, forks, and spoons. We can buy recycled wood, different knife, fork, and spoons. But what you're talking about is the little packets mm-hmm. that come that you mm-hmm. get with a napkin and salt and pepper and a knife and a fork and a spoon, and all I needed was the spoon.
Right.
But me as the restaurateur, I look at it as, for years the way I looked at it was, well, they might use the fork and they might, and they've made it so much cheaper for me to buy the whole package than it is to buy the onesie-twosie, and of course they're much less quality. But that's a good one to consider because that was always the reason. And it doesn't make sense at all when it comes to it. So the rationale was there, but it doesn't make sense at all.
Well, we're all in this together. If you have a question for Chef Rosie, it's easy to ask.
Send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public.
And next on Main Street, what's happening?
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week I chat with Lindsay Tremuda. She's a food journalist and author of The New Paris, The People, Places, and Ideas Fueling a Movement. We also hear from a reporter who covered a pilgrimage in India where 4 million women cook rice porridge. We also offer a recipe for steam marmalade pudding, and wine expert Stephen Muse talks about the perfect champagne glass for New Year's. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, we know the new year is coming up pretty quickly here, so that's something that's going on, and people will be celebrating that in many different ways.
I can't believe it's already almost 2018, but here are some fun events for winding up 2017. Let's start with this one. The Fargo Force Wiener Dog races at the Shields Arena on the 29th between 7 and 10 p.m., where people who have wiener dogs are putting on their little booties or little salve you can put on their feet and having them run out on the ice for 15, 20, 30 seconds. Not long enough to hurt the puppies, of course.
We don't want
to do that, but they're going to go run on the ice for a few seconds. And then what that does is helps raise money and awareness for all of the many animals who are living in shelters right now and who are looking for permanent homes. So this is at the Shields Arena, December 29th, 7 to 10 p.m.
The art exhibit Evolving Genesis is open Monday through Saturday until January 20th in Jamestown at the Jamestown Art Center Gallery. It features the work of Jamestown artist Brad Bowl. People are probably familiar with his family's business, Bowl Ironworks, but unaware of Brad's formal art training. His subjects have presence, whether they be bison, longhorn, or horse, and they'll call to you from across the gallery. That's how good these paintings are. The hours of the gallery, 9 to 5 weekdays, 10 to 2 p.m. on Saturdays. It's closed on Sunday, and the admission is free.
There is a snowman building competition on the 29th, just outside the James Memorial Arts Center in Williston, North Dakota, from 1 to 3 p.m. The Arts Center will be providing cocoa and cookies. Mother Nature has already provided an abundance of snow, so get out there, put it to good use, and build a snowman. Again, 1 to 3 p.m. on the 29th at the James Memorial Arts Center in Williston.
Hairball, an 80s tribute band, is Friday in Grand Forks at the Alaris Center. Hairball is a live music experience featuring lights, sound, video screens, smoke, fire, confetti, and screaming diehard Hairball fans, creating an event that will remind you that 80s glam rock will never die. Starts at 7 o'clock Friday at the Alaris Center. It's $20 for tickets in advance, $25 on the day of the show, so you got a day to save $5.
I'm assuming there's also going to be lots of hairspray and maybe some bad perms.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. miniature art show at the Mondack Heritage Center in Sydney, Montana. This is already up and going through January 20th. The miniature art show is now in its 27th year. And talk about artists having an eye for detail here, because they are asked to build works of art no larger than 5 inches by 7 inches. And sometimes the work of art they're creating is as small as a postage stamp. And this includes watercolors, acrylics, mixed media, oil painting, cast bronze pieces, 5 to 7 inches tall here. Prizes awarded to the top 3 entries. Go check it out. It's already on display and will be on display through January 20th at the Mondack Heritage Center in Sydney, Montana. Free admission to this. The hours are Monday through Friday, 10 to 4, and Saturday, 1 to 4.
Back at Jamestown, the University of Jamestown Shootout is Friday and Saturday. It's going to be held at the university's Harold Newman Arena in Jamestown High School. It's the Shootout has doubled in size. 25 North Dakota and Minnesota Class B girls and boys basketball teams. The play starts at noon on Friday and goes until 9 p.m. That is Friday and Saturday. A one-day pass is $14 for adults, $12 for students. A two-day pass is $22 for adults, $20 for students. Kids 5 and under are free. Lots of basketball in Jamestown at the Jamestown Shootout.
You have this weekend to check out Jurassic Quest in Minot, the 29th through the 1st. And this is dinosaur adventure for the whole family. Lots of dinosaur exhibits here with ultra-realistic, life-size, animatronic dinosaurs, more than 80 in all. You can interact with them, learn about them. Some of them are even built for riding, and there is even a little area where future paleontologists can dig out their own archaeological treasures. Friday, 3 to 8 p.m., Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. in Minot, and tickets are $18 to $34.
I Will Not Go Gently continues through Sunday in Moorhead at Theater B's new location, which is 10th Avenue and 2nd Street North in Moorhead. 80s rock legend Sierra Mist is ready for her comeback tour, and so are her fans, or are they? Theater B founder and veteran performer Carrie Winterstein is Sierra Mist. Jennifer Child's clever one-woman show plays with our sense of nostalgia and shines a light on our quest for self-actualization and new beginnings. The curtain is at 7:30 tonight through Saturday with a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday. Tickets $20 for adults, $10 for students, $5 for students on Thursday evenings.
All right, my pick of the week is a New Year's Eve salsa masquerade ball at the Radisson in Fargo, December 31st at 9 p.m. until 1 a.m. It's just $10. For another $5, you can get a masquerade mask there. And this includes bachata dancing lessons and a dance social and a champagne toast. Check it out at the Radisson.
Well, mine is Cabaret for a Cause, Saturday in Fargo at the stage at Island Park. ACT UP Theater of Fargo-Moorhead is partnering with Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota to present Cabaret for a Cause, an evening of entertainment to benefit the LSS Refugee Resettlement Program. Cabaret for a Cause features former cast members from ACT UP shows like An American Idiot, Next to Normal, Spring Awakening, Bear, and Rent. The evening of entertainment will also include beer, wine, and appetizers for those who take part in the $50 VIP ticket, which starts at 5 o'clock with that reception. Otherwise, it's at 7 o'clock, and the cost is $10 in advance, $15 at the door. It's a Cabaret for a Cause at the stage in Fargo, and that's what's happening.
Coming soon, the winners of the 2017 Third Coast Competition, the best audio documentaries of the year.
Can you see me? Blink once for yes.
I go at night so that I can't be seen.
Police are seen.
The dash cam video reveals the sequence of events during this critical minute.
Stand by for police.
Listen for Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival here on your public radio station.
Best of the Best 2017, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
I wondered what I could possibly say to lessen the impact of this fiasco, but I stayed silent. I'm originally from New England, and this is a common strategy.
We pretend something hasn't happened by not talking about it.
Join us for more true stories told live. The theme, high anxiety. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 28th. North Dakota's Supreme Court has changed a fair amount from its early years. Since 1910, members of the bench have been elected on a no-party ballot. In 1930, term limits increased from 6 to 10 years. In 1985, Beryl Levine became the first woman to serve on the court. One change took place in 1908, when it was decided to add 2 seats to the court. Voters had passed a constitutional amendment in the general election that raised the number of justices to 5. The referendum passed with almost 70% support. It was on this date in 1908 that the State Bar Association adjourned a special meeting and sent Governor John Burke a letter with its nominees of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans to fill the new seats. The governor selected Republican Sidney E. Ellsworth, a Jamestown attorney, and Democrat John Carmody, who had served terms as Hillsborough's mayor and Trail County's state's attorney. Ellsworth and Carmody began their appointments in January of 1909, but their tenures were short-lived, as both were defeated in the 1910 election. Carmody became an assistant attorney general and eventually an assistant U.S. attorney for North Dakota. He died in 1920. Ellsworth returned to his practice in Jamestown and later served as counsel to the State Highway Department. He died in 1945. Today, 5 justices continue to sit on the North Dakota Supreme Court, and new appointments continue to be filled with the assistance of a judicial nominating committee of the State Bar Association. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
A woman who lost both of her parents to addiction has been on a lifelong mission to avoid addiction herself and to educate others about the disease.
I think my first advocacy day when it comes to addiction was in kindergarten. For my first show and tell, I came to school wanting to talk about heroin and that you shouldn't use it.
The importance of increasing awareness around addiction. That's on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, once a month, we put together an editor's roundtable to talk about the big stories of the month. And, of course, this month rounds out 2017, so we will have analysis of the stories we talked about for a year. Our roundtable editors always include Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. He'll be joined by Jack Zaleski, the former opinion page editor for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and veteran reporter Lauren Donovan. We hope you can join us for Main Street and our editor's roundtable on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.